Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In the next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Ed Epp from Hope and Healing. So what's the latest with Hope and Healing?
Yeah, we've had a lot of changes at Hope and Healing. We've changed our name, but more importantly, we've emphasized a focus on children. We used to work with all disabilities and a lot of adults, and increasingly we're focusing on children because we believe that to actually break the cycle of poverty and disability, we should start with the younger generation.
So how do you go about spreading the word about the work you do?
We do it in a variety of ways. We do have processes to go to Ottawa and talk to the federal government about the work and the importance of disability inclusion in all development. I think that's one of the most important things that we can do in Ottawa. The federal government and other organizations do great work, but a lot of them actually miss the disability angle, and we believe that you're not really going to address poverty if you don't address disability, because the poorest people in the world are those that have a disability, the families that have a disability, and you can see it throughout the world and even in Canada. In a community, the poorest families are those that are struggling with a disability.
So what are some of the key programs that your organization offers?
Sure. We do prevention, we do care, and we do rehabilitation. So prevention is trying to address disability and discover impairments at a very early age. So we're working increasingly with doctors and midwives in countries in Africa, particularly, to identify disabilities, because if you can address them right at birth, clubfoot, for example, you can actually prevent the disability. If you address prenatal care and the mother, care of the mother and the birth experience, you can actually address issues of cerebral palsy. So that's the prevention side. The care are when you have a need an intervention, wheelchair, intervention and operation to straighten legs, left lip and palate, addressing a specific impairment that that can be addressed. And then long-term rehabilitation is with the care that you've done. There are many children that still need to have ongoing care in their community, particularly cerebral palsy, where, you know, you're training the mother to do the exercises with the child. You're actually linking the mother with other mothers with who have children with cerebral palsy, so they don't feel so alone, and they can get hints of how to do things, and you have ongoing rehab in the home.
So, in your work, since you mentioned some of it has an international component, do you find anywhere that you go there are still some myths surrounding disability?
Oh, that's a huge problem. In Africa in particular, people with disabilities are thought to be cursed. Their family is thought to be cursed. Many times you find, you actually don't find people with disabilities. They're hidden. Sometimes it's not a purposeful hidden. It's just the mother has to work, and so she has to put the child with cerebral palsy in a room somewhere and go out to work, and that child's left alone all day. But certainly the whole thing of being cursed and something's wrong with the family. I would say that element still exists in Canada to some degree, too. It's easy to criticize other countries, but I do see some of those elements in Canada.
So how do you go about clearing up said myths?
I think it's creating opportunities for the mother, in particular the parent, and the child to actually enter into the community and be part of the community. I think with all of our experiences, the myth that we have about another group, if you want to talk about groups, is when you have actual relationships with them. And so having a child in the school changes those children around that child, changes the opinions of them about the myth. And so I think you address it that way. You address it through, in some countries like Ethiopia and in Malawi, there are family groups that do programs in the community. In particular, I'm thinking of Ethiopia, where the coffee ceremony is a big part of the community, where you have a whole hour-long process of finding the coffee beans and grinding them and roasting them and then making it. And then and in that social atmosphere, you talk about the myth of disability, and particularly if you could find people in the community that have a disability that can be leaders, that changes the myth dramatically. I remember in Zimbabwe meeting a man who was in a wheelchair, and he was so proud to show me his business. He sold batteries and watches, and then he took me to his house, and he said, "I have the best house in the neighborhood." And he destroyed all kinds of myths by just, he had a family. I think that's the way you destroy myths.
So what's been the greatest success that you've witnessed in all these travels?
That's a great question. I think the greatest success is when you see a child get it. We believe that increasingly that the moment of impact, we could do a lot of intervention, but it's when the child actually believes that they have value. There is a moment that you can see it in a kid, and I can go into a family home and I could tell right away if that kid believes that they have value, believes that they deserve school, believes that they deserve friends, or they're just going through the motions yet, and we have to still work with them to get them to that point where they can believe it. But I remember a little girl in Malawi, and she had cerebral palsy, and we went into the village, and all the other kids came around us because we were obviously outsiders and they wanted to know who we were. And she stood up on her walker and looked at the other kids and with confidence told them, "Get away. These people are here to see me." And I you could tell that she believed that she had value, and they will have the resiliency to break through the barriers that they're going to encounter. We're not going to destroy all the barriers, but if we can get them to believe their value, they will break those barriers themselves.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
This next segment of our show, we'll hear from Juan Osuna. He'll be telling us a little bit about adapted martial arts. So tell me a little bit about your work in terms of adapted martial arts.
Well, the story is very simple. My own, I've been a karate instructor for most of my life, and I have a son with cerebral palsy, and that's how it all started. When he was very little, he's going to be 18 soon. When he was very little, we kept going to physiotherapy, and I started thinking, well, you know, all these exercises that that the physiotherapists are suggesting, I can do through karate and make it a little more fun. So we decided to, you know, get him involved. At that point, he used to use a walker, right? You know, the prognosis on him was kind of uncertain. Nobody really could tell if he was ever going to walk without an aid. We just used karate. I didn't have many expectations. I just thought, you know, we'll use this and see how much better he gets. And later, a few years later, he was walking. He was part of the Canadian national team. And then we, you know, because he plays ledge hockey too, and people started noticing the improvement in mobility. So parents started asking about karate. People at the children's hospital had a lot of comments also about what we had achieved, and we started getting references, right? People coming and then trying it. Also. Yeah, due to the fact that my wife is a special ed teacher, right? There's a combination of things. It was just a natural process. We never really sold our program. We just started getting people, and nowadays we work with. We have a few kids with cerebral palsy. We have kids within the autism spectrum. But we don't do segregated classes. We work everybody together on the same in the same class.
So,
yeah.
So how do you go about tailoring a program for someone with cerebral palsy or autism?
Cerebral palsy for me is actually quite natural. Usually, what we do is we tell the parents when they call asking for information. We tell the parents, "Well, why don't you come? Bring your kid. Let's try a class. That way the kid knows if he likes it or if she likes it. And we get a sense of what the impairment is or what the limitations are. I mean, we try not to work with limitations. We try to work with the abilities of the kid. And it becomes a very natural process because our dojo is a bit mature, and most of the people in my dojo, my son is going to turn 18 soon, so I've been used to working with, have seen people with disabilities in their, most of their karate lives. I get a lot of help with from my advanced students, and, you know, we get suggestions, and I ask, right, you know, what do you think we can do with this person? And we usually don't say no. We just say, you know, we do a little bit of planning and invite them to come and join us. Not all of them stay. Like a regular karate class. I mean, there's a lot of people that come and try a class and don't stay. There's some that stay. We don't do. We just try to adapt what we do to the needs or abilities of that special person or specific person.
So, in your time creating such programs, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Yes, a couple. I mean, and success is a very ample word. I mean, we have a girl who was actually CP, and it's inside of a autism spectrum too, and who started, she first came in with a walker, then she went to some crutches, and now for the last year she's been training with no walking aid. And but that's not the only success. I mean, it is the confidence and all the evolution that she's gone through. For us, I mean, she has become a very important person in our dojo. We want her there all the time because it keeps us real. The progress, I mean, this is a girl, I mean, imagine the combination of cerebral palsy plus autism. And is very challenged. Some emotional controls and things like that. We used to have to interrupt all the classes because she would have a panic attack or something like that. And nowadays, no, she's just another person in our class. To me, that's success. I mean, we run a very, also a very sport-oriented program, so we've also have, my son Santiago has made it all the way to the national team. To me, success is not medals. It is what progress or what impact we have had on that young person, right? I mean, we have another one of our students who was using crutches initially to train, and not much after that he wasn't. He's walking on 2 feet, and to me, that's a great success. I mean, that's a life lesson. Now they can, you know, these kids can go about life without using a walking aid. And when they use a walking aid, it's because it's a safety thing. It's icy or something like that. But for most of their lives, they're now walking freely. I mean, obviously with their the limitations that a cerebral palsy can give you, but other than that, they're a little more independent.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Les Rendezvous de la Francophonie is an annual celebration that promotes the French language, heritage, and its many cultural expressions. Let's celebrate from March 1st to March 31st, 2020, across the country. Discover the RVF 2020 online newspaper at rvf.ca. Take part in many activities in your region and enter our national contest for a chance to win cash prizes or a trip to Switzerland. For more information, visit rvf.ca.
Welcome back, Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Ed Epp from Hope and Healing and from Juan Osuna, who told us a little bit about adapted karate. This next segment of our show, we'll hear from Sarah Fields, who will be telling us a little bit about Epilepsy Awareness Month. So tell me a little bit about some of the happenings with Epilepsy Awareness Month.
So we've got lots of exciting things going on this March. Our ongoing March, we have hashtag PurpleDoor2020. So this is when we're encouraging schools and businesses across all of southwestern Ontario to get involved and show their support for Epilepsy Awareness Month. So we're encouraging businesses and schools to decorate their doors purple. And if they enter their photos on social media using hashtag PurpleDoor2020, then they'll be entered for a chance to win a prize at the end of the month. We also have going on Wednesday, March 18th at 11:15 a.m., a family-friendly movie morning. And that'll be at Devonshire Mall. We'll be going to see the movie Arctic Dog. We're also hosting another Strike Out Epilepsy event. So this is a bowling night, which will be held Sunday, March 22nd at 4:30 p.m. And this is a family-friendly event. March 26th is Purple Day, so be sure to wear your purple attire, maybe even encourage a dress-down day at schools or at businesses. And last but not least, our volunteers will be helping to bag groceries at the Malden Road Fairs to help raise awareness for Epilepsy Awareness Month, and that'll be Saturday, March 28th. So if anyone's interested in any of these events or for more info, they can call our toll-free number at 1-866-EPILEPSY by email at info@epilepsyswo.ca or by checking out our website at epilepsyswo.ca.
So how do this year's events of Epilepsy Awareness Month compare to previous incarnations?
So we're doing things that we feel will benefit the family. Some things that we've realized is that it's not only important to raise awareness about epilepsy, but it's also very important to get the entire family involved as well. That's one of the things that we've noticed across Windsor-Essex County is trying to just build a support for our kids, for our parents, and also for our grandparents as well.
So what are some of the key challenges in raising epilepsy awareness?
It's really getting over a lot of the myths that people have when they think about seizures or they think about epilepsy. It's this idea that a seizure looks one particular way. So that would be what most people might have heard as grand mal or what we now call tonic-clonic. But there are actually over 40 different types of seizures and different seizure disorders. And it's just raising the awareness that 1 in 10 people will have a seizure at some point in their lifetime. It doesn't mean that they have epilepsy, but 1 in 10 people will have a seizure. 54 Canadians are learning that they have epilepsy every day. And there are currently over 300,000 Canadians who are diagnosed with epilepsy. So it's just getting over the fact that epilepsy is not something that's well talked about in our community. So we're just trying to get over that that stigma and any myths or any discrimination that's there.
So in your time doing epilepsy awareness, has there been any success case that stands out for you?
Even last week, we went to Devonshire Mall. We had an info booth, and there were some people who came up who have epilepsy or they know someone who are diagnosed with epilepsy, and not even knowing that our services are in the community. You know, a lot of people, when they're diagnosed, they might shut down and not really know where to turn to, and that can be something difficult. So when we are present in the community, having anybody who, you know, comes up to us and says, oh, I didn't know that this was around, or I didn't know that this existed. And that did happen last week at Devonshire Mall, which was fantastic.
So what message would you send to the community about the need to get beyond the myths and to gain a proper understanding of this condition?
I would say that, you know, it's important that we understand and that our community takes the time to educate ourselves about not only seizures and about epilepsy, but any type of challenge or exceptionality that somebody might be going through. And I think that the best way to do this is through schools and trying to get involved in our schools to educate our young people that, you know, sometimes people might be a little bit different than us. You know, but that doesn't mean that, you know, that they're really different than us. And I think that understanding that at the end of the day, we're all the same and we still want the same things out of life. And like I said, I think that going into our young people is one of the best ways to do that.
So beyond the month itself, do you have any next steps lined up?
Well, we always have, we'll be hosting our fourth annual run. That will be this September. We're still working out a date for that, but stay tuned. We're also hosting throughout the summer the International Mug Run, we'll be hosting one of their events. You can check out our Facebook page for more information on that. So just basically staying informed with our website and with our Facebook page just to keep up with current events. But we're definitely looking at hosting a lot of events this summer specifically for our kids, and we're in the works of putting those on right now.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Of course. My friends, it all comes down to awareness. And I love hearing campaigns like the Purple Door. It's just amazing that people are making such a stand about disability equality in such a noteworthy way. It's unique, truth is. Fact is, this is something that is likely to get the public asking questions. Fact is, the matters surrounding disability life are only shrouded in secrecy as long as we don't ask the question. Fact is, you find a lot of people who are just a little squeamish about saying, "What's the nature of your condition?" or "Is there anything I can do to be of support?" There are many people with disabilities will be glad you asked. Admittedly, there are those who won't be as grateful. There are always going to be this divergence in personalities and thought. I mean, some people, they want you to ask. They want you to say, "What does this purple door mean?" or "How can a person in a wheelchair adapt to do martial arts?" or "How can someone who's nonverbal get in there and get an education and be counted as an equal," which is as it should be. A lot of people want you to ask the questions. And in society, we are really backpedaling in some ways, in terms of wanting to be so correct and proper in some ways. You find yourself saying nothing at all. The fact is, if you only go surface level in your questions, you only get surface level in your answers. Depth of thought, asking the questions of yourself, if no one else. What does this disability mean to me? What's the first thing that comes to my mind? Have I ever met anyone with this condition? Or am I just buying into what society says it probably means? Independence of thought is hardly a crime, my friends. It comes from a place where you're showing a genuine interest in disability life, wanting to get to know these people of strength, dignity, and intelligence. And the fact is, we can only form opinions based on experience, our lived experience. We have to decide whether this is something that matters to us. But I can't answer the question for you. That's your question. I know, in my mind and in my heart, there's not enough conversation surrounding certain things. Take, for example, mental health. Yeah, there are some great events out there. There really are. But as someone recently reminded me, disability is not a nice, comfortable coat you slip off at night. It's easy to see someone on a very public forum talking about mental health issues. What happens when that person goes home and they have to deal with it? Are we still their support system, or is it easier for us to forget? Fact is, we have to make our understanding really extend to the core of our being. We have to recognize that for us, yeah, it might be a matter of providing support in a day, but to someone else, this is their life. This is a big part of who they are. It does not make them less of a person, or weaker, or of diminished capacity, if you will. It makes them an adapted human being. And there is no shame, no curse in that. It is all in how we use it. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me, you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.